Hello, I'm John Frankham.
And I'm Henry Marsh.
And I'm Laura King, and I set up the John King Brain Tumour Foundation. This is our first podcast, so we're really excited about it as a charity. If you love this and you want to donate anything, absolutely fantastic. But more importantly than anything, just enjoy listening to these two exceptional, great guys who we love.
I've spent most of my life in hospitals, and it gradually dawned on me what absolutely horrible places they are. And yet, to my shame, I didn't really appreciate this until I met my second wife 22 years ago, who's called Kate Fox, who's an anthropologist, and she actually wrote a book about horse racing, so she knows all about John. And it's
which
great.
Is why she's not it's here this
great, evening. No, it's a great shame. She would love to come, she couldn't come, it's a great shame. But she's got Crohn's disease, which is not nice, and she's been in hospital many times, and she pointed out to me just what horrible places hospitals were. And the other point was that for many years I worked in a hospital in Wimbledon called Atkinson Morley's, which had been built in the 1870s with money from a London hotelier called Atkinson Morley. And after the war, the hospital morphed into a civilian neurosurgical hospital. It became the biggest neurosurgical hospital in Europe at one point. And to cut a long story short, it had gardens and big windows. And I worked there for over 20 years. So each of the wards actually had large balconies outside them. But of course, any hospital manager, if you see a balcony, they immediately see all the patients will be jumping to their death over it, like lemmings. So nobody was allowed on them, neither staff nor patients. And it took me 7 years to, not persuade, I had to find all the money charitably to turn the balcony outside the two neurosurgical wards into a garden. And actually, the view over the rooftops of Tooting is much better than you might think. And I'm often asked, now giving medical lectures, you know, what are your proudest neurosurgical experiences? I've done lots of things. I've worked in Ukraine for 30 years. I pioneered a wake craniotomies, all that sort of stuff. But actually, I always say the same thing. It was making that garden. Because I'm afraid nobody else would have done it, almost certainly. And it has made more difference to our patients' lives and their families, almost anything else I could have done. All my technical achievements, somebody else would have done sooner or later. Ukraine is a long and complicated story. So it has been marvellous for me, having retired, but Laura, alas, because of John's death, has taken this on, has kept it, made it much, much better than when I created it. And now there are plans to extend it. And one day in the distant future, hopefully, when you enter the rather boring St. George's site, you'll be met by a whole sort of green wall. And I'll say one final thing. It's very curious that when we're dying, when we're in hospices, if you're lucky enough to get into one, only 15% of people at the most do, we have gardens and pictures and flowers and a serene environment. Why is it only when we're dying we're allowed to have this? When the evidence is overwhelming, if you put people in a good green environment, they will get better more quickly. So if you can contribute to this, I assure you, you will be making a real difference.
How did you come to work at St. George's in the first place?
Well, kind of by mistake. And I went into neurosurgery late. I went into medicine late. I went through all the privileges of an expensive private English education, so I did nothing but Latin and Greek. No science. I think I did science O-levels, but I can't remember.
Got a feeling I didn't either.
Yeah.
It's quite extraordinary. Now, at no point during my education did anyone say to my parents, I think your boy's going to be a brain surgeon.
I remember various people expressing great doubt about it when I decided to become a doctor. But I did various things. I left school when I was 17. I went to Africa as a VSO teacher in these very post-colonial days, when a 17-year-old school leaver could teach Africans. Most of my students were older than me. I spent another year doing various odd jobs. Went up to Oxford University to read, as we call it, PPE, not personal protective equipment, but politics, philosophy and economics, and ran away, much to everybody's horror and my family's horror, because it was an Oxford academic family, and worked in Newcastle, or north of Newcastle, in Ashington, England's largest mining village, where the Charlton brothers came from, as an operating theatre porter, again through a weird connection, the girlfriend of a friend of mine, her father was a general surgeon at Ashington. I wanted to go to the Northeast to absolve my middle-class guilt complex. Jane rang her father up and said, I've got this funny friend of mine who wants to run away from Oxford University and work in a hospital. So he said, all right, tell him to come along with me. I spent 6 months, and during that time there working in the operating theatres, I realised I wanted to have a middle-class career after all.
You said there was a really nice porter up there.
There were some really nice porters. They were really nice, and I really liked the Geordies, no end. And they coped with me very well, you know, having a posh southerner like me. They always thought I was a bit odd, but they were actually very kind, and that impressed me as well. So I decided I wanted to have a middle-class professional career after all, one of my own choosing. So I was allowed back to go to Oxford University, which again I didn't think would happen now, having run away, and worked like a lunatic, got my degree, and then was able to get into medical school. And it's so much, we were talking about sport, it was so much luck involved. We've both been highly successful in our careers.
It doesn't matter how hard you work.
But it's still, so much depends on luck and actually the kindness of other people. Yeah. And that's not false modesty on my part. It really is alarming, actually, how much I realise that. And then by chance, again, by pure accident, I saw a brain aneurysm operation. I was working as an ICU doctor at the Royal Free in Hampstead and saw an aneurysm operation, and that was it. And it really was.
What was it that attracted you?
It was microscopic.
Yeah.
It was very fiddly and precise. It was incredibly dangerous and incredibly dramatic. All that appealed to me massively. So that was it. I knew exactly what I wanted to do. And I think it's more or less, we tell lots of fibs to ourselves about our past and invent stories about ourselves. But I more or less went back and said to my first wife, I'm going to be a brain surgeon. And I never really looked back. And that's how it happened. But in terms of going to St. George's, when I was training 35, 40 years ago, you had a whole series of steps. You had an interview, and you had a junior doctor, junior house physician, junior house surgeon, senior house officer, junior registrar, senior registrar, at least 5 jobs, 5 interviews, quite different from now where it's all seamless. And when I was a registrar, I went round to talk to one particular senior neurosurgeon, a very nice man called Jason Bright from Southampton, to look at all the various senior registrar jobs which I might apply for. And we discussed them all, and he looked at Atkinson Morley's, and he said, well, I'd look very carefully at Atkinson Morley's if I was you. So I thought, right, well. So in fact, a job came up there as a senior registrar, so I applied for it, and rather to my surprise, I got it. And then two and a half years later, I became the consultant. I replaced the senior man who was retiring. And I met Jason Bryce shortly afterwards at a medical meeting. And he said to me, you must have thought that was the worst advice you ever got. I said, I thought you meant I should apply for it. He said, no, the opposite. Because the two consultants were such complete bastards.
Oh, wow.
It was a notorious place for training at. So that is how I ended up at Atkinson Morris and St. George's. It's all because of a misunderstanding.
So I read a lot of books, and they fall into two categories. They're really good, and I recommend them to all my friends, or I don't recommend them at all. But whatever they are, I never remember anything about them. No matter, I've read Grapes of Wrath 6 times. I couldn't name you one character in it. So I thought, there's no point in me rereading these books until just a couple of days before this evening. Otherwise, I'm going to forget everything that I want to ask him. So I send Henry, I've never met him before, send him an email with a list of questions that I thought might be quite good. And he writes back a really nice email with all of the answers. Of course, then I started rereading the books 2 days ago. Every question that I've asked him is answered in the book. Now, he must have been sitting there thinking, that lazy pig.
No!
Hasn't even read a book. And he never mentioned it. So he is a genuinely nice person. So I'm really thrilled to be here tonight, because the books, by anybody's standards, are excellent.
We're not here to sell my books, we're here to sell the charity job.
But the people have already paid their money, so we've got them here already.
All right.
then if they were paid on the way out, it would be a different matter. But hopefully they've already paid to be here. But you mentioned that you knew exactly when you saw that operation, yes. When you wanted to be a brain surgeon.
Yep.
When did you know you wanted to be a writer?
I've written all my life. Well, he's from the age of 12. I started keeping a diary at the age of 12, a daily diary. At the age of 22, I destroyed it all because I was so embarrassed by it, which I regret now, because I'd be quite interested to see what a kind of prune I was when I was a teenager. And some of the music has to do with that as well. And it was a kind of... it became a duty and a habit. It was a bit intermittent at first, but as my job as a consultant got more and more stressful, and as my first marriage went more and more on the rocks, it became a sort of major source of therapy for me. But I never reread it. I rarely reread it. And then after my first marriage ended, which is now 23 years ago, I met Kate, who's an extraordinary person. And actually, it sounds like terrible folly. She's actually much smarter than me, and she's a brilliant writer. I was just writing an article this morning for the Royal College about assisted dying, and I thought it was pretty good, and then I showed it to Kate. It was so much better after she looked at it. The same with my writing. Everything I write to, I show to her. And anyway, I mean, she would ask me, what were you doing at work today? And I'd sort of pull out my laptop and what was yesterday and read a bits of it. I said, oh, yeah, you ought to go and see my literary agent, because she'd already written a great big bestseller called Watching the English. So that's how I became a writer, because my wife told me to be. But I didn't really think of myself as a writer. It's just kind of me.
If I had the wrong profession, or you could have been another Ian Fleming or something?
No, I don't think of myself as a writer at all. I think I've been incredibly lucky to have been a doctor. And it's very difficult, and I think being a doctor now in the NHS the way it is a lot more difficult than when I was particularly a young doctor many years ago. But I just think it's a fantastic privilege to have a job where you go home at night. Just by doing your work, you're doing good. You don't even have to try to be good. You know, it's lots of challenges.
But it's exhausted reading the book. I mean, it sounds incredibly hard work being a surgeon.
Yes, it is. But it's curious. I still don't really understand this. That, as I tell you, I was talking to the president of the Royal College of Surgeons, who I know very well, called Neil Mortensen. He's a really nice guy, actually, unlike an awful lot of doctors who go into Royal College politics. And I said, Neil, do you miss it? Because he was a very eminent gut surgeon. He operated on my wife with Crohn's disease, among many other people. And he said, all I wanted to do when I was in practice was operate, but now I don't miss it at all. And I'd say exactly the same. And I still find that quite hard to understand, because it's an addiction. I mean, it's something we were talking about with your book job. And that extraordinary movie some of you may have seen called Free Solo, about this guy who climbed El Capitan with no ropes. I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary. I mean, I'm not like that, but I can understand some of that, the addiction of danger. Because that's what the sort of surgery, I particularly did dangerous brain surgical operations, sort of massive tumours and aneurysms and things like that. But the interesting thing about that is it's dangerous. Your fear, the anxiety which makes it so exciting, is that the patient might do badly. I mean, if you didn't care what happened to the patient, it wouldn't be exciting.
As opposed to being a jockey, where your fear is that you're going to injure yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And you were saying you're meeting all mates all in wheelchairs. Yeah. I mean, it sounds...
Well, listen, it's part and parcel of it.
Yeah. But that's what makes it meaningful, though, isn't it? The fact that it is dangerous.
Yes, but it's, you know, I can't even comprehend opening somebody's head up. I mean, the difference between us, if it was a car, I would be changing the wheels, Henry would be looking behind the dashboard, fiddling around with the wire. I mean, it's just incredibly complex.
But it's training, isn't it? It's as you do it over and over again. One of the problems as doctors, particularly as surgeons, we all get instant respect, instant kudos. Particularly brain surgery. It ain't brain surgery, which is actually a false ideology. It seems to me that why we deserve respect is because we fail, because we have to live with failure. If you do sort of surgery of the sort I did,
Because the worst thing, the worst, I mean, it's always terrifying if you're sued or if there are complaints. But without a doubt, the most awful aspect of being a brain surgeon is if you operate and you leave somebody terribly damaged, which happens. Not very often, but it happens. And then having to see that patient every day on the ward round is torture, and to see the family and to try to maintain a trusting relationship when you failed is not good.
I've got somebody,
and that's why you deserve respect if you can cope with it.
I've got somebody who lives next door to me who used to be in charge of recruitment in the war.
Yeah.
And she said, you never put a one ulcer person into a two ulcer job. And when I've read your book, I just know, you can see what a really sensitive person you are. So it's almost like, why on earth would you want to go and be a brain surgeon when you've got all this crap to deal with, anguish and suffering?
I asked myself
that
too.
It must have been a struggle to find the worst job for you.
I mean, I know a few neurosurgeons who are probably a bit psychopathic. I mean, in the sense, psychopathy meaning not having empathy. So you don't actually care.
Yeah.
Or it doesn't hurt you very much when the patient comes to harm. But actually, most surgeons, in my experience, do hurt when the patients come to harm, but we don't talk about it. And maybe that's right. I'm not saying we should all... You know, what's unusual about my first book is I was really the first senior doctor to write about this aspect of the work.
Well, incredibly honest. I mean, the one line that I remembered, without having to look it up, was a bit where you said, every brain surgeon has a cemetery of patients.
Yeah, that's right. Well, actually, that's a quote by a French neurosurgeon called Larisse. No, I wish I'd written it myself.
Yeah, well,
you're having
my line, so don't disappoint
it's
me.
It's a great line. Yeah, we do.
Have you ever had, like, golfers get the yips, where you sit into that chair to do an operation and you think, my God, and your hands start shaking?
No, never. Never. I don't think so. And I was always nervous. I'm sure you were nervous at the beginning of a race, and if you're not nervous...
Normally you're nervous coming back in when you've got to explain to the owner why it hasn't worked. But if you're a good footballer or golfer or whatever, everybody can see you. When you do an operation and you must think, Henry, you've done a great job there, is there anybody within your team? Do you have the same team? Is there somebody that says, bloody hell, that was a good job there, that would know, and, you know, whether you get some
sort of
feedback?
On the whole, you don't. As a trainee, you do, but when you operate, usually, it's changing a bit in ways we might talk about later, you have a trainee with you. And although one's position as a trainer is not the totally authoritarian relationship it used to be, on the whole, as a trainee, your career is totally in your boss's hands. So you don't comment or criticise on your boss, other than to...
But nice, you know, it'd be nice for you to do something that you're really proud of, doing an operation. You think, God, not many people on the planet could do that.
I did know. I when I was a young consultant, I was like that. And I'd occasionally walk home over the water of the ponds of Wimbledon Common. But then you start having a few catastrophes, and then it all changes. And that's, you asked me one of the questions, did I listen to music when operating? And the answer is yes, I did, for quite a few years. And then I had a series of absolute disasters. And I'm not talking about death, I'm talking about leaving patients in persistent vegetative states and terrible straits, horrible things like that. And I just totally lost my appetite for listening to music. I just didn't want to do it. It seemed somehow indecent. I'm often asked, what's your advice, what's your single bit of advice to the a budding surgeon? I say, ask for help, because that was not the atmosphere I was trained in. My atmosphere was
that frowned upon when you were doing.
Yeah, it was see one, do one.
Yeah,
you know, right. The next case is yours, and usually be somebody at the bottom of a social ladder, so there'd be less trouble if things went badly. There was much less supervision, so you learnt very, very quickly, but you made lots of mistakes in the process. Now the pendulum's gone to the other extreme, that there's almost too much supervision and not enough experience. If I could change the NHS, I would. Well, there are lots of things I'd do. But one
well,
is...
I'd put you in charge of the NHS.
Well, I'd have the juniors working 80 hours a week, which is what happens in America. That's for surgery, anyway, depending on the specialty. But then you'd have to have what's called two-tier cover. You'd have to have two junior doctors on call. at night, and that would cost money. And the money's not there.
You would be Tony McCoy if you were a jockey. He's the most driven human being. He cannot understand anyone doing anything unless they're going to win. And G. Armitage, who's his PA, said that she was going to run in the marathon. And he said, "Will you win?" And she said, "Of course I'm not going to win." And he couldn't get it into his head why she would want to run in a marathon if she wasn't going to win. And I think you're a bit like that, aren't you?
Yeah, I think so. And I'm the youngest of four. And my mother said, "I was very nice for the first year of life. But from then on, it was very difficult." And yes, I mean, people who know me would say I am very driven. I've calmed down a bit with old age. But coming back, it may sound embarrassing. We were talking about Maggie May and early love affairs. It is extraordinary looking back on my life how love, women, sex has been so wonderful and embarrassing at the same time. And we all say that for ourselves. Now, I'm now in the very bizarre position of having prostate cancer, and I've been chemically castrated, which at the age of 10, it doesn't really bother me at all. And I think, well, maybe it would have been much better if it had been done earlier. And I read this extraordinary article that in China, apparently, wives have been, if you go to vets, you can get a drug called stilbestrol, which was how they castrated Alan Turing, the great computer guy, for his homosexuality. And apparently Chinese wives go and buy stilbestrol and give it to their husbands. They feel they're erring. And then middle age, slip them castration pills. It's true.
Yeah.
Extraordinary. But if it hadn't been for testosterone, I wouldn't have my family, I wouldn't have my children, I wouldn't have my granddaughters, which is the most precious thing in my life. So as of everything, it's yin and yang.
Yeah, absolutely.
Two sides.
Bit of this, bit of that.
But God, I was such a prat at times, John, honestly.
But men are.
But I want to ask you, and how many races, do you ever count how many races you ran in?
No.
Tens of thousands.
But I was like you. I never wanted, you didn't know you wanted to be a surgeon, and yeah. I never wanted to be a jockey.
Yeah.
And I didn't know, I was just in the right place at the right time. I wrote a book called Born Lucky. I went to work for the most amazing trainer called Fred Winter. And he lived about 50 miles from where I was in Swindon. I'd done loads of riding, but not interested in racing. And I'm about a stone and a half heavier now than when I was riding.
You don't look exactly overweight.
Well, I'm not overweight, but I was too heavy. So I packed up because I was fed up with being hungry the whole time. But he was a lovely man, no sense of humour. So I go...
Isn't that a bit of a contradiction?
Well, he was... No, you can be a lovely man with no sense. He definitely was. And he was the most loyal person in the world. And without him, I would probably still be cleaning cars or being in prison or doing something. Yeah. But I went for the interview and he asked me how much experience I'd had riding. I said I've been show jumping and stuff. And I said, look, what I don't want to do is come here, be cheap labour, work hard and not get any opportunities. I said, well, you know, what do you think of the chances of me making it as a jockey? And he looked at me and he said, well, your biggest problem is going to be your weight. You've got big hands and you've got big feet. And he said, what's the lightest you've ever been? So I said, about 7 pounds, 3 ounces, I think. And he looked at me and he didn't even smile. And I worked for him. He was the most unbelievable human being. And I stayed with him for 15 years. I rode for him. I had loads of opportunities to go ride for other people. But I started with him, stayed with him. We had a great head lad called Brian Delaney. Learned how to do everything well, and Fred used to train all the horses exactly how he wanted to. Never a question of how much is it going to cost. That's how I want to do it. And at the end of the year, if he made money, you know.
And what's the difference between a successful jump jockey and a less successful one? Can you nail it at all or not?
Well, you can see, because unlike you, if you want to look down the racing post, you can see this year that Brian Hughes has ridden 200 winners. He's had 1,600 rides, £150 a ride. You can see how much prize money he won. So I should think he's been up and down the country, and he works like you did when you started off. Absolute workaholic, same as Tony McCoy and all the lads that do well. But loads of people work really hard. The top's like any sport. The top 10 earn a reasonable living. but get down after that, and if they're clearing 20 grand a year, they're starving themselves and risking their neck. If they're clearing 20 grand a year, be very few of them doing that.
So what's the critical difference between the top 10% or top 1%?
It's getting on good horses, getting recognised and being consistent.
So it's a bit of luck.
A little bit of luck. And just having a little, you don't want to get injured when you're getting going.
Right, yeah, and that's partly luck. Yeah.
Well, that's partly luck. Yeah. If you're an apprentice jockey and you've never had a ride and you're an owner and you want to employ somebody to ride your horse, you'll pay exactly the same amount to employ Frankie Dettori as you would a young lad who's never ridden. Right, well, thank you very much. Massive thank you, Henry.
Please remember, it's about gardenizing these horrible hospital balconies. And again, as I said to begin with, it really will transform the experience of patients in the Atkinson Morley wing of being patients in hospital. It really, it's a really good thing to do.
Well, it must be said, if you say it's the proudest thing that you've done.
It's the proudest thing I've ever done. And I really mean that for all the other things I've done. This has made more difference to people's lives than anything else I've done. I've no doubt about that.